You're tuned to WHBK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You are now listening to the Sitting in the Park show. Today is a special show because I have up in here Kevin Rowan, who was in a few groups. He was in a local group called the Mystiques and a group called Raw Umber, and then he was later in the Sons of Slum. So you should definitely plan to listen. We'll be talking about his career and all the music that he was involved with today. So first of all, Kevin, thanks so much for coming up to the studio.
Sure, no problem, Bob.
So first of all, what part of Chicago are you from?
South Side.
Okay.
Actually, originally from, started and lived on the West Side.
Okay, when did you move south?
Oh, now you got me thinking. At the age of 11.
Okay.
11. Yeah.
So what neighborhood did you move to?
Maple Park, which was a community built from the ground up, 115th to 119th, which I would say from Sangamon to Justine.
So that was just east of Beverly, pretty much?
Yeah.
Okay. And how did you get involved with music?
Well, since you asked me, well, actually, my dad played before I.
Okay.
And
what did your dad do?
Oh, he was a drummer. He was a jazz drummer.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Did he play in local jazz groups? Did he play in recordings?
Yes. Actually, he played on, like, three recordings, two... with the King Fleming Trio.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what was your dad's name?
Royce M. Rowan.
Okay.
Royce M. Rowan.
And is that how you got into music? You got into playing drums? Did you get into singing? What did you do?
Well, actually, watching him, I can remember dad working at night, and mom would say, okay. Oh, I had a older brother, which was 2 years older than I was. And mom would say, okay, your dad's going to be on TV tonight. I remember this one really good. And so we sat up there and watched dad on black and white TV. Don't ask me what station it was.
What year was that?
Oh, goodness, now. Let's see, if I had to have been about between seven and eight.
And you saw your dad play drums on TV.
Dates then, maybe, what was that? Maybe about 58.
Okay. So, so that was one of your first experiences seeing your dad involved with music?
Yeah.
Seeing him on TV.
And actually when he had a trio. And when he had the group come up, we lived on like the second floor. And he had we had a piano already, but the bass player would bring his bass up, and I was amazed with the size of this thing. But then my dad had his drums set up.
Okay.
So, and then they played music right there in the dining room.
Okay.
And my brother and I was sitting there watching them.
So you grew up sort of seeing your dad, mm-hmm, and his jazz group perform.
And taking us different places where they performed to.
So did you start singing first or playing drums first?
Let's see. Now, I would have to say playing the piano first, because in Catholic school, we took piano lessons.
Okay.
And then after that, got into drumming, watching my dad.
Okay. So, do you remember how old you were when you started playing drums?
Actually, probably since we had moved out that way, probably around 11 or 12, I know. Yeah.
Okay.
11 or 12.
So, ultimately, this is the first musical thing that I know you recorded. You were in a high school group called the Mystiques.
Right.
So, how did that happen?
Well, actually, in the neighborhood, there weren't, I think we were like the first band, and I used to practice all the time, and some guys said, well, you know, there's two brothers that live down the street, and that's Greg McGee and Larry McGee. They play guitar and bass, and maybe you guys need to get together. So some kind of way we got, you know, I met them, and they said they played, and we got together, and we were like the first group out there in the area.
Mm-hmm. So, and was that before high school, when you were in high school?
This was actually maybe freshman year, towards the end of eighth grade or freshman year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So your freshman year of high school, you had a band together, and then How many? And you got a fourth member of the group too, right? Is that?
Yeah. Now Basil and I, we went to Catholic school, Holy Name of Mary together.
Okay.
So he could sing.
Okay.
So we included him, and that's how we became the four Mystiques.
So, what was Basil's last name?
Hughes.
Basil Hughes.
Yeah.
So, and how did you come up with the name the Mystiques?
I don't know. We sat around after one rehearsal and we tried to figure out a name. I don't know if it was Greg or Basil, because usually these were the more technical guys, Basil and Greg, and we kind of came up with it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to play the record, or I'll play a side of the record, and then we could talk some more.
Sure.
So that people know what we're talking about. So
okay.
This record, it actually got released twice. First as the Mystiques on a label called Or, and then as the Mystiques on a bigger label called Twinite. So this is the Mystiques with So Good to Have You Home Again. Okay, that was just the Mystiques with an excellent Chicago record called So Good to Have You Home Again. It got released on a couple labels, and if you're just tuning in, I have member of the Mystiques, Kevin Rowan, who is up in here talking about his records and the music that he made. So we were just talking about how you were in that group in high school, and you were originally just a band, three guys, mm-hmm. and you got the lead, Basil Hughes,
right.
as a lead vocalist. Mm-hmm. So what's the story, first of all? How did you end? Do you know how you ended up cutting a record?
It was, okay, the keyboard player that my dad played with, King Fleming, he was already on Chess, and I guess him and my dad and I think somebody else was involved, got together and said, well, let's go on, take them in to the studio.
So they produced your record, pretty much,
right.
your parents.
King Fleming, right. Yeah, and my dad.
Okay, and So we had talked about how you were a band and a vocal group. So did you actually play on the record?
Yes, I'm playing drums back there.
Okay, and the McGee brothers are playing too. What do they play?
They had bass and guitar.
Okay,
and King Fleming played keyboards on there, the piano.
Okay, and did you play while you were singing, or how did the recording work?
No, actually. For it to come out the best way possible, we would lay down the music track first, and then we came back and we stood around the mic and we sang the harmonies, and Basil had his mic and he sang the lead.
So you recorded it in, all the harmonies were on one mic and Basil had a separate mic?
Right.
Do you remember where you recorded it? Was it in a real studio or like in a basement? What was it, sir?
I believe it was at Chess.
Okay.
Chess label. Right.
And, one thing that's interesting is you started off as a band, but you had very sort of nice harmony on that record.
Well, thank you.
So how did you end up sort of transitioning? Like, first of all, did you sing when you were in the band?
Yes, sung background most of the time. But then we did, they would bring me out front and I would do, well, let's put it this way. The stair steps were going on then, 5 stair steps.
Okay.
So everybody like mimicked them, and I had a voice that could do some of the stair step lead.
Okay.
And so
you were inspired by the harmony was inspired by the 5 stair steps.
Right.
So, but did you guys sort of sing harmony before you got Basil in the group, or he sort of inspired you to do that?
It all came together.
Okay.
All at once, yeah. It, like, came together. Yeah.
And who do you remember who wrote those songs?
So Good to Have You Home Again.
Yeah.
That definitely was Greg and Basil. Basil wrote the words and Greg most of the music. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then the other side is good too. It's called Put Out the Fire, which I'll play next.
That's the one I like too.
Okay. And who wrote that song?
Both of these guys, Basil and Greg.
But Basil sings lead on both songs, is that right?
Right, yes. And we do the background.
Okay, well, let me play the record and we could talk more. This is The Mystiques with The Other Side of the Record. So, and one thing I wanted to ask you about is, I know you didn't remember the exact details, but the record originally got released as The Mystiques, mm-hmm, on a label called Or, and then it got released on the Twinite label as The Mystiques.
Okay.
And I know there were a bunch of Mystiques groups, including one from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
You don't remember the details as to either the name change or any of the record labels you were on?
Now, from what I can recall, during that timetable, we had the record. It was mentioned that somebody else had the same name, so we kind of like changed the name of our spelling.
Okay.
And from that point on, I guess, you know, it was released that way.
And I remember in your high school yearbook, there's a photo of you guys.
Mm-hmm.
It was in, I think, the 1970 yearbook.
Oh, high school, yeah.
Yeah, and it was, you guys went to Finger High School, right?
Correct.
And in the yearbook, it was spelled The Mystiques. So all I know is it's a 1970, you were still The Mystiques.
Yeah, talent show.
So let me play the other side, and we could talk some more. This is The Mystiques with Put Out the Fire. Okay, you are tuned to WHBK 88.5 FM in Chicago. That was just the Mystiques with Put Out the Fire, the other side of their first record. And if you're just tuning in, I have Kevin Rowan, member of the Mystiques, who not only sang but played drums on that record and the other record. So on that record, you were just telling me that you actually had one other guy just in the studio with you singing backup.
Yeah, his name was Wayne. He wasn't actually a member, but he like hung around us, and he kind of helped us with the harmony.
Okay. Do you remember how long you were together before that record came out?
Not really. It just about through high school, and you're talking about, I don't even remember when the actual date of the record coming out. What do you have? Do you have any date
on
that?
I'm guessing around 1970, 71, something like that. Probably the end of your high school.
Yeah.
So you were probably together for three or four years before that came out.
Well, actually, considering sixth grade, what's that? About from sixth grade on.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But you didn't get Basil until
No, Basil was there when I came in. So, yeah, we were all together.
So you were there for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So what did the group do? Like, did you do talent show? Like, can you talk about what the group did before you did the record?
Okay. Like I said, King Fleming, which he was a piano player. He and my dad was still playing. So they would take us around to different clubs, and I remember this one, the Starlight Bowling Alley on 71st. It was a lot of places they would take us and we would play.
So you were just kids and they would take you as like
right
as a band and
to
play.
Show us off. Oh, but I almost forgot. We had, how can I leave this out? We also had encompassed a couple of girl singers during the time.
Okay.
Went on this record. One was, we'll never forget, she was a pretty girl, Marcella Buchanan.
Okay.
That was back in high school. She finally moved away. And then there was a Letitia Donaldson. She went to Finger, too. So they didn't cut on these records, but we used them, too, when we were playing.
So was your band called The Mystiques?
Right.
And it was like The Mystiques, and you had you guys playing and two girls up at
no,
the
not at the same time. We would have one girl at a time.
Okay.
So it could be, when we'd go out, sometimes it would be like five of us. But mainly, the girls didn't stick around too much.
And what kind of stuff did you do when you did your shows? Did you
Cowboys, the girls.
Okay.
Funky Broadway, Wilson Pickett. Tracks of My Tears by Smokey. a lot of Smokey, a lot of Temptations. What's this? Well, I can't think of this one. But the things that were happening then. And James Brown, there was a time, Cold Sweat.
Okay. And you talked about playing in a bowling alley. Did you actually play at nightclubs, or were they like bowling alley type places?
Yeah. And then, I don't know if you can get away with this on there. There's no cursing involved.
Okay.
But we would play at these affairs where, I guess, like they'd have a dancer, okay, and you'd have your setups. I remember those really good. Those that are old enough know about those setups where you bring in your own liquor.
Okay.
And you'd bring in, I think, the club would furnish like your ice and cups, but you would bring in your own liquor. Playing at clubs like that, I remember as a little boy.
What do you mean, a dance, like a stripper type dancer?
Well, see, you said that, I wasn't going to say it.
Okay. Okay. But it's pretty funny, you were really young. You were really young,
right,
and playing at these like private clubs.
Right.
And was it just you guys playing, or you and your parents, like King Fleming Trio and some other groups too?
Usually we would just basically be playing. Yeah, they would usually just use us as a showpiece.
Okay.
It was fun. We got maybe, $10 a man sometimes.
That's exciting, though, to be a kid and seeing all this stuff. So then, that when your record finally came out, you must have been excited that you had a record out.
Oh, yeah. Actually, the neighborhood, we had distributed ourselves. Actually, King Fleming and some of his people had taken it around, and you know, we knew we were on a Chess label, but basically it was sold in the neighborhoods, you know?
Okay, so it was mainly just like a local high school record.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't remember it ever getting played on the radio?
No, not that.
Okay. And you don't remember ever, like, signing a contract with either record label, like Twinite Records? Because Twinite had some hits. They had Syl Johnson was their big artist, and the Notations and the Dynamic Tunes were on it.
I think we may have signed something when we were young.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we may have signed something, you know.
But pretty much, it was they didn't really distribute it or get airplay.
No big airplay.
So, when did you graduate from high school? Around 1970, 71?
70.
Okay. 70. So, did the group stay together long after that?
I'm trying to think. No, I think we had split during that time.
So you split up soon after high school.
Right.
And you had told me before that your group had done backing for some other people, too.
Oh, yeah. During that time, Draken and Solids.
Okay.
They were a neighborhood group.
So they also were from Morgan Park.
Right.
And do you remember how you met Draken and Solids?
From what I can recall, you know, going to practice in Greg's basement, because we would alternate my basement, his basement. And I think Drake and the guys were there. One, you know, they were like 3 years older than us.
Okay.
And I said, "Hey, little guys, you wanna do backup with us? You know, I mean, play backup? Sure, why not?"
Yeah. Okay.
And I remember one of the guys. Well, as time went by, maybe a year or so, was crying the blues because he was drafted into the Army and he had to go to Vietnam.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that. Okay, you're saying one of Drake and the Insolids was drafted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd be interested in knowing any of their names, I guess.
Well, you ask me, I have to really think about it now.
So what types of shows did you do with them? Also, like, talent shows? I'm just wondering what the venues were like down there. Like, was there a talent show at your high school?
At my high school, it was. And actually, anyone that has the old Finger yearbook, you'll see us in there with some other groups. And they got, I was surprised, a shot of me carrying a drum down the aisle.
Okay.
it was just like a show thing, that's all. Playing the drum as I was walking. And then, Draken and Solace, I think we did a Morgan Park talent show with them.
Okay.
In Ada Park.
So there were lots of local talent shows at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what types of places did they hold the talent shows?
Ada Park was one of the parks we would go to. It's still, on 112th? And
so it was just like, it's just in a Chicago Park District park.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you had talked about how the group had broken up around 1970, right after you left school, pretty much.
Somewhere around there, yeah.
So did what happened? Did you guys just decided to move on to other stuff?
I'm trying to remember. During that time, I'm trying to remember which one came first. Was it Orange?
Okay.
Or...
And then there was Raw Umber also.
Right. I'm trying to think of which one of those groups came first. Was it Orange or Raw Umber?
So, but those were both groups you were involved with.
Right.
So what was Orange?
Orange was... I met these guys in college.
Where were you going to school?
Central YMCA, which is now is no longer, was over there, I think, on Lake. And I think, I believe it was Larry during that time. Larry was the bass player, Greg's brother.
Okay.
And he knew of two guys, a keyboard player, Brian, I can't think of Brian's last name, and Paul Botrytis. Paul played guitar.
Okay.
And I think that they came that group came before.
So you met them in college. Where were you going to school?
Central YMCA.
Oh, that was the school. I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Okay.
So you were a mixed race group, right?
Right.
So there are two white guys.
Two black guys.
And what kind of, you played like funk rock? What kind of music
things that were like out in the 60s. I do remember Sly and the Family Stone, some originals that Paul had written and the keyboard player had written. I remember this one tune, Layla? Well, one of those two.
Okay, so you played like kind of classic rock and classic.
It was a mixture, but it was our technique that did it.
Okay.
It was totally different. And when we went to these colleges playing, I mean, they loved this group because they never heard of that mixture sounding. It was kind of like a, like a 60s rock and funk together.
Okay. And were you aware at the same time, like, Chicago had a lot of the white groups, a lot of them, they were like horn rock, funky rock groups also. Were you part of that whole scene? Like, I know there was like the group Chicago, and then there was a bunch of groups like that that had that kind of sound.
We were more or less close to like a Santana.
Okay.
You know, because we didn't use the horns during that time.
Okay.
No horns. And our sound, it was tight. It was really good.
But you guys never recorded anything?
No, no. No recording. I think Paul's still playing today somewhere.
Okay, like maybe he was in other bands later.
Mm-hmm.
And then you became part of a group called Raw Umber.
Right.
What's the story with that?
Okay, how did we get with Raw Umber? Greg and I were still playing, and I think Larry, that's his brother, the bass player, got kind of lazy, and it was hard keeping up with him practicing. And so I don't know whose idea was. It comes to me as I'm talking. During this time period in high school now, there were these brothers, Al Massey and Vince Massey. Al played guitar during that time. His brother played drums. And I think Al wasn't doing anything during this time period. So it was more like a word of mouth. Greg got together. Greg and I were together. And we knew of this other group named, Mario. Mario Hayes he played like Jimi Hendrix.
Okay.
And the drummer's name was Bill. And the bass player's name was Herschel. Now, you want to know, all of this is coming back as I'm talking now.
Okay.
I know they had a group. They lived in Augel Gardens, or what's close to that? Golden Gates.
What was the name of their group?
I can't even recall the name of their group. But okay. They sounded identically like Hendrix. And Mario sounded exactly like Hendrix. And they were like hot over there in the Golden Gate area, and we were hot like over in Maple Park. And I remember someone said, well, you know, there's this bad guy plays drums named Bill Ratliff. They said, I know you, you know, Kevin, I know you play. So I think that's how we like got together, because we heard of each other. Now we're talking about two drummers that were supposed to have a background of playing, right?
Okay.
And so we finally got together, and we had a standoff of drummer on drummer in the basement with the guys, you know, playing music. And I think that's how we met Bill. We already knew Mario from high school. He went to Finger also. So as time went by, as we kind of like started folding, somebody had the idea. I think it was Bill, the other drummer. He said, let's get together with, you know, have two drummers.
Okay.
Two drummers and during that time, now this is unique. during this time, a lot of the guys lived in the South Shore area.
Okay.
And then I think Bill and his wife, they had a baby, and Herschel and his wife, they had a house, I think, on 113th and, I want to say, Bishop Loomis, one of those streets. And then this is where Chaka Khan came in, because she lived there, too.
Okay.
And you know, we used to all hang out at the house, you know, and
I know she had a group around them, the Shades of Black. Did you know about that?
The name sounds familiar.
Okay.
But we all used to hang around, and that's how we got involved. But anyway, during this time period, I think Bill, again, had mentioned having a group with two drummers, and so that's how Raw Umber got its start. But actually, before Raw Umber, we were called Rated X.
Okay, so you originally you formed a group called Rated X.
Rated X.
And that was in the early 70s sometime?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you became Raw Umber.
After that, yeah.
And so Raw Umber was a band, and there were vocalists?
Yes.
And singing lead was Greg McGee of the Mystiques.
Right.
And so how long was Raw Umber together?
Oh, I guess about 3 years or so, maybe.
And did you actually do shows with them?
That I was with them. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was unique. It was fun while it lasted. You hear tunes like Soul Sacrifice.
Okay.
By Santana. Well, I should have told you that at first. That was a lot of the sound that we produced. We
So you were also like a local band that played, different things. And then, so Raw Umber actually ended up cutting a record, but it was after you left the group, and it was called Love One Another.
Right.
And it was actually put out on Greg McGee's father's record label, Virginia Records.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't sing on that or anything.
No, no, no.
And I think on the record there's some girls singing on it too. Do you remember anything about women in the group?
No, I know it was some groups. I think a couple of the girls that were doing, like the time we were hanging around, they had groups. I remember these two sisters. One was named Sherry. I can't recall the other one, but they were singing. So I'm thinking it was most likely them.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, had you joined the Sons of Slum yet?
No, actually, this is very unique. When I say one that's unique, because we had like Raw Umber, we kind of like fell out.
Okay. So you had an argument.
You don't want to go into that.
That's fine. I'm sure every band has arguments.
Right.
Yeah.
and actually, I always said they did me more of a favor than, well, actually, us, the two drummers, Bill and myself, we got in each other's way.
Okay.
Playing drums. So actually, they actually did me a favor when I had left the group.
So you had an argument and you left the group.
Actually, they put me out. Let's put it that way.
Okay. And then, so how did you end up joining the Sons of Slum?
Well, during that time, I think I was with a group. This lead guy's name was Chuck Bernard, and I was playing with him.
The Chicago singer, Chuck Bernard?
Chuck Bernard, yeah.
Okay.
I didn't tell you about that, huh?
No. So you were, Chuck Bernard was a solo singer and you were in his band?
Yes.
Okay. And so you were singing with him, and Sons of Slum was already a group that was together, right?
Yes, yes. These stories are very, it's interesting. The first that you want to hear of how I first heard of them and got with
sure.
them. Okay. During this time period also, I was going to college, YMCA, and I was working at the post office. And during the time that we were working, a lot of the girls that I was working next to, it was called Assembly Belt.
Okay.
And we're putting mail on the belt.
Okay.
And they went on and on. Oh, Sons of Slum, we saw them last night. Ooh, girl, they tore it up. And they kept on, they ranting and raving over the. That's how the first time I've heard of them.
Okay.
And during that time again, I was, like I said, I was playing. And I remember asking them, I remember saying, you know, as much as you guys are talking, nobody's as bad as Sly and the Family Stone.
Right? Okay.
And they said, I don't know about that, but you really have to see them, you know. So I had it in my mind that I was going to see them. So I would see these. Back then they had the cardboards that they put up on the lampposts.
Just like posters for the show.
Posters, Sons of Slum and Weapons of Peace. So Sons of Slum and Weapons of Peace. So actually when I finally did get a chance to see them, I kept trying to see them like at the High Chaparral in different places, but it was always sold out. I didn't get a chance to get in. So it was one Easter show, and I can't forget this. It was an Easter show at the Erie Crown, and who headlined but the OJs? OJs, and I remember OJs and Sons of Slum. They opened up.
Okay.
And my girlfriend and I remember we had seats all the way in the back, all the way up at the top. And so during this time period, when they opened up the show, Shaft, the song Shaft, was really hot.
Okay.
With Isaac Hayes. And they, Sons of Slum, had opened this show. And I don't know if it was Clinton Jen or somebody, but it was Field in there. And he said, ladies and gentlemen, are you ready? Give it up. And by the time he said give it up, the girls had yelled and screamed, jumped out of their seats, ran all the way down to the front of the stage and encircled the stage. Now I have to give the listeners an idea of how this looked. So you have this backdrop of a movie theater, movie screen.
Okay.
The lights are dim and the strobe light is going. And by the time when they started off with Shaft, the song Shaft. And by the time they hit that first note, they went a band pit down up under.
Okay.
And by the time they hit that first note, they rose up from the pit. But prior to that, all you could see, it looked like silhouettes of giants
okay.
on the screen. And by the time they finally hit that note and they hit the lights and the girls were screaming, and I saw, what did I see? Multicolored wigs, chains, mirror outfits, boots.
Okay.
And by the time they went through their set, I said, now I see what they're talking about.
Okay.
And I remember this. You have to hear this. The girlfriend that I went with during that time, which was Sandra Edwards, I looked at her and I told her, I said, you know, I was just talking. I said, the only thing they're missing is a drummer like me. And I'll never forget that. And that's how I first saw them. So now, I think, must have been maybe 3 years, 2 years had passed by, and somebody had mentioned that they were looking for a drummer.
Okay.
Sons of Slumber.
What, do you know what year that was?
77. Yeah. Because I was 20, I remember I was 25 when I got with them. So, what was that? Don't have me do the math now.
Okay. I don't know. Well, but like mid, like 74, something like
yeah.
that. So they had already cut their records for Stax and Gamma before you were in the group.
Right.
And sorry, I forgot to ask you this before, but you said you were with Chuck Bernard right before you joined
right,
him.
Right.
How did you get to be part of his band?
Oh, it had to have been word of mouth, because Chuck Bernard lives, I think, like 111th, somewhere around Loomis, Bishop, just in one of those streets. He actually didn't live too, we didn't live too far from each other.
Okay.
So I don't remember exactly how I got with Chuck. But we did. We stayed together quite a bit.
Okay.
We did a lot of songs together.
So then how did you end up joining the Sons of Slum?
Okay, so going back. Now, so there was someone that mentioned that they were looking for a drummer. And I was still playing, but of course, I would, in the neighborhood, every now and then, you would see the Sons of Slum truck.
Okay.
You'd hear of them, and of course, they were hot in Chicago. Oh, they were hot. And so someone had mentioned they were looking for a drummer. And they said, well, you can find them at this club called the Punkin' Room on 71st Street. 71st and Jeffrey. It was a bowling alley. And all the musicians on Thursday night would hang out and you could do free sessions. And that's what I had seen Shock in there. And quite a few, everybody would basically hang out there and get a chance to play. But I remember someone said, well, you know, you can find them there that night. So I remember my encounter with, it was James Bennett, the lead singer. And one night I was there, and someone had mentioned, well, there's James over there. He was in the front of the stage, and he was watching the group perform. And I remember walking up to him and touching him on his back, saying, hey, I understand. Hey, how you doing? My name is Kevin Rowe, and I understand you guys are looking for a drummer. And he turned around and looked at me, and he turned back around and kept watching the show. I said, okay. So that was the first encounter.
Okay.
So I think someone had mentioned also that, well, you know, they hang out at the High Chaparral. And so I wasn't going to chase nobody around, but, you know, I knew that they were looking for a drummer. So the second time, at the High Chaparral, I would see some of the members come in after, you know, their shows, and they would hang out. Of course, they were celebrities. And I remember going to the bass player, Frank, and I went up to him and I said, hey, I understand you guys are looking for a bass player. A drummer. My name is Kevin. He said, oh, yeah, well, you know what? Here's my number. We rehearsed it such and such and such. So that's how I got the number. And I remember going to rehearsal for the first time, and of course rehearsal was at 12 o'clock.
Okay.
I had set up my drums and everything. I don't think the band members got there until about like 3 hours. 3 hours after. And they finally came in, right? And so I said, hey, well, let's see what you got, you know. So they called off a few tunes, I hit it, they called off some more, and then they said, hey, you got it.
Okay.
He got the job. So I said, okay, you know, thanks, you know. But if I was determined to go back and speak to James about my first encounter with him. And so during rehearsal, after I had gotten with the group, I said, hey, James, you know, hey, man, oh, James, oh, man, we're glad to have you, man. Yeah, you fit the bill. I said, remember that time at the
Is that the bowling alley?
The bowling alley, the Starlight. Oh, I said, that was me to tag you. Oh, I'm so sorry, man. I was kind of high. I didn't understand, you know. So, okay. We were cool after that. And that's how I became a member.
That's cool. So it's interesting that, like, you saw the group and you were blown away by them and you made it your goal to become a member, and you became a member.
Actually, it was the wording that I said. I had no idea when I saw them that I would be their drummer. You know, when I told you about the Airy Crown.
Yeah.
Oh, I left this out too. During that show, also, after Sons of Slum finished that first set, the DJ said, "Now for the OJs." Do you know the crowd said, "No, Sons of Slum"? So we let them play another number. They did not want to hear OJs. That's how hot Sons of Slum were during that time period.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to play. Let me play. I think their biggest hit was "The Man."
Okay.
And then we could talk more about your career with them. So this is the Sons of Slum with "The Man." Okay, that was just the Sons of Slum with, I think, their biggest hit in Chicago called "The Man." And it's interesting that we were just talking about how they started off their show with Shaft because it was a very sort of Shaft-inspired record. And if you're just tuning in, Kevin Rowan, who was a drummer for the Sons of Slum, is in the studio now talking about his career. So, Kevin, you're not actually on that record, right?
No.
But you joined, like, pretty much after the Stack stuff was released.
Correct.
And so when you joined the group, I know originally their manager was Purvis Staples, is that right? Was he still the manager?
He was. They were just phasing each other out.
Okay.
I knew of a guy named Ken Freeman.
Okay.
That lived on the north side. I was dealing with him with some other groups, too. Because I, you know, played with various other groups. And I had mentioned to him and to the group that, this guy would do the managing.
Okay.
And so after Perv, we had Ken Freeman.
So, and with Perv, actually, there was a whole bunch of unreleased material cut but never released.
I believe
And you said it was recorded at Cody's studio, probably?
Right.
And then when you joined the group, you ended up getting a record deal with Capitol Records?
Correct.
What's the story with that?
Well, okay. Actually, it was three groups that had signed, and Tavares was the first one. We were second, and it was an all-girl group. Don't ask me the name. I don't remember. And that was the order. Tavares was supposed to, their records was supposed to come out first, and then we would follow. So they sent Larkin Arnold, Larkin Arnold helped Curtis Mayfield write that Superfly album.
Okay.
And that little flap on the front of the cover, if you turn that over, you'll see Larkin Arnold.
Okay.
But I remember they sent him from Capitol Records, and they gave this guy $8,000 for 2 weeks to do our songs. Well, yeah, we basically did it in 2 weeks. And
you're saying you went to the studio and recorded whole albums worth of material?
Right.
Okay.
Because all it needed was to be recorded. We already knew the material, you know. So, during this time, we had already signed. And I left this out. When we talked to the guys that signed us, said, "Okay, you know, Capitol Records. You know, we're very serious. We don't mess around. We have people like Sammy Davis Jr., Nancy Wilson, and if we pick you guys up, we expect this, that, and the other one." And we're saying to ourselves, yes, this is it. We're on a top label.
Okay.
And they said, this is the order. It will be Tavares, you guys, and this all-girl group. So at any rate, Tavares, their first record came out, and they were doing really good, really hot. And I think in the span of a year, we're saying, yes, well, you know, it's about our time. So I think, within the year's time, we kept in contact with them. And we said, well, what's going on? Our manager would call up, what's going on with our record? They said, well, since Tavares is doing so good, we decided to shelf you guys' record and put all our eggs behind them. And you know we're hot now. We're hot. So we tell them, well, okay, fine. Just let us go. No, we have you for a year. You know, you can't do anything for a year. And that was a heartbreaker right there.
So they kept you locked in but didn't release
anything. That's right. And they kept the album. And that's the one I did play on. But
you actually have it on tape, the unreleased album.
Yes, that's the... You shouldn't let them know that. But okay. I got it on tape.
But it'd be good if someday it got released legitimately.
Yeah.
So, one question I had is, do you know Capitol Records wasn't based in Chicago, right? So do you know how you got hooked up with them at all?
I don't know if it was through our manager, but we had,
They did put out a bunch of Chicago stuff. Like, the biggest Chicago thing they dealt with was Patty Drew.
Okay.
And Patty Drew was on Capitol Records.
Okay.
But you don't know how you got hooked up with them, so.
No, I think it was through our manager, word of mouth. We had a lot of great opportunities. Remember the group Chase?
Yeah, the horn rock group I was talking about.
Their manager, we cut. Oh, I didn't tell you. We went to the studio. I think we cut 204 sides. And that fell through because he was going to put us where he claimed Chase was.
You're saying the manager of Chase was going to put out Sons of Slum?
Oh, we had, yes.
That was after the Capitol stuff?
After the Capitol stuff, right.
Okay.
They had went down the plane, sorry to say, had finished the group off, all the members were killed. And I think through our manager, they were going to have like a co-op, partnership. And anyway... he came to us, the group, and said, you know, I lost my group. You know, you saw us on TV, Johnny Carson. I'll put you exactly where they were. But you have to be serious. So we say to ourselves, oh, here's our another shot.
Okay.
So we went to the studio, and I think we cut at least about four sides. And so the story is it's kind of an embarrassment, but anyway, here it goes. Anyway, got into the studio, and he calls our manager back and says that, well, the record deal is off. And we're saying, why? What's going on? You know, he says, well, one of your members tried to take a guitar out of the studio, and I'm finished with you. And I remember speaking to him, and I don't remember his name now, saying, well, look, whoever took the guitar, we'll fire him, and we can continue on. He said, no, that's it. So that was the end of that deal.
Okay. And you probably, did you have any other, so you pretty much got unlucky with with recording deals and contracts.
You want to hear of these ones?
If you have any more stories.
There are stories.
One thing I wanted to ask also is, you guys were very kind of psychedelic and flamboyant at the time, especially the lead, James Bennett.
Yes.
I think he had, like, underwear on his head or something like that.
His American flag. He had a worn out on his head for burning a flag in Texas.
Okay.
Yeah. That was during the hippie movement during that time period where you couldn't do those kind of things.
So when you joined the group, did you have to become all psychedelic looking also?
Well, actually, with Rated X, we were already that way.
So you already dressed in crazy psychedelic clothing? And
yes, and when I got with them, the members, I remember saying, hey, you fit right in. Of course, we had been watching Sly and the Family Stone, so.
Okay, but I bet you didn't have American flag underwear on your head.
Oh, no. I did have, however. I had a green wig and a yellow wig to match my outfit. Yeah, that was something back then.
Okay, and then, so the group was together through a bunch of failed record contracts, record deals.
Right.
How long did the group stay together?
Oh, are you talking about the time that I was with him or prior?
Well, we talked about when you were with him, how long did the group stay together?
We finally dismembered in 78.
Okay.
What had happened, everything was just falling through. Nothing was going right. And I remember one of the saxophone players then, Herman Weatherford, said, well, look, one of the ex-impressions, he had some jobs down in New Orleans. And we remember telling the group, hey, well, let's go down to New Orleans and try to do something. Most of the members, you know, through failed marriages, the ups and downs of getting kicked out of apartments and this kind of, you know, well, didn't want to go. So Herman and I decided to go.
Okay.
And
do you remember which member of the Impressions?
Oh, Nate. I think
Nate Evans.
I think that's his last name. And now Nate is he's singing with the Temptations. I think I saw him.
Yeah, he is. Plus, he had a record on Twinite Records.
Okay.
He had the last record on Twinite Records.
Uh huh. Okay. So we went to New Orleans with him, and during that time period, of course, we borrowed our PA system from the group. Brought it down there to utilize. And I guess some of the members, you know, felt that we weren't coming back, so they started selling the other portions of the equipment. So the whole thing just, you know, well, I remember saying, okay, well, tell them to get this back, and we'll send this back since, you know, nobody's breaking up the group. But that's how we finally, you know, broke up.
So it was kind of like you had a lot of bad luck and sort of were there any other big major labels you were almost released on?
Okay, going back. After the Capitol record, these are some interesting, but I guess I should just share it with the listeners. At one time, after the Capitol record, we had a meeting, the group, Sons of Slum, and we were saying, hey, we got to do something. So somebody suggested, well, let's go to L.A., take our material, since we had a material, and see if we could find a record deal. And so somebody said, okay, fine, you know. So we said, well, everyone can't go. So we saved our money, and of course, Maurice was the leader, and I was like the business person of the group. So Maurice and myself, we went.
Okay.
So we went to L.A., took the material, and I'll never forget, we were there about a week or two, and we were staying with a friend of ours named Beverly Reed. She had an apartment down there, and Beverly worked at the office where the Stars were. And during this time period, I remember going, Maurice and I went to where she was working, and we met Jane Kennedy, Joe Jackson Fine's father, some of the other stars during that time, Superfly, Ron O'Neill. But anyway, I remember sitting in Beverly's office, Maurice and I, and I saw, looked like Joe Jackson walked past the office door. And I said, "Hey, Beverly, isn't that Joe Jackson?" She said, "Oh, yeah, his office is right down from mine. You can go down there." I said, "Maurice, come on, let's take the record."
Was it the Motown Studios at the time? Was it Epic Records?
No.
It was just some office.
Well, it was an office where the Stars were. It was around Capitol.
Okay.
In the Capitol recording industry. But I remember, Maurice was scared. I picked up the album and went to Joe Jackson, and I said, "Well, hey, I'm Kevin Rowan, you know, with Sons of Slum." He said, "Yeah, I heard of you guys from Chicago." I said, "Well, is there anything you think you can do for us?" He said, "I would really like to help you guys, but, you know, Jermaine just left the group, so I'm really tied up with him. So, you know, best I could do is pass on your number or something." Well, that didn't follow through worth of anything. But anyway, going back, during that day, going back to where we were staying with Beverly, before we came back to Beverly, Maurice and I finally went to RCA.
Okay.
And we went into the studio with the album. This guy said he liked what he... I'm making a long story short. He liked what he heard. You know, come back tomorrow and we'll sign a contract. And we said, "Okay, Maurice, here we go again. We got another deal." So we came back to where we were staying with Beverly. And we said, "Beverly, guess what? We finally got another deal." She said, "Oh, that's good, you know." She says, "You all want to go to a party tonight?" We said, "A party? No, we can't go to no party because tomorrow morning we got to get up and sign this record deal." She said, "Okay." We said, "Well, whose party is it?" She said, "Well, it's Aretha Franklin and Glenn Thurman. They want you guys to come on their ranch and party with them." So, you know, Maurice and I are looking at each other. Oh, what are we going to do? You know, it seems like it's no big brainer, right, to pick which one we want to do. But we felt that if we went to Aretha's party, we were going to be drinking and the other, and during the time it's time to get up in the morning to sign a contract, we wouldn't be able to.
Okay.
So we decided no, because we got what we came down here for. We got to sign papers tomorrow. Of course, we weren't utilizing a lawyer during that time. So, of course, we woke up the next morning, went down to the office ready to sign, and the guy changes his mind. "Oh, I'm sorry, you guys. I had a change of mind." Of course, Maurice and I look at each other, right, and say, "We should have went to that party." Why? Because had we gone to the party, we would have met some of everybody and anybody.
Okay.
Knowing Aretha Franklin, we would have met, our spectrum would have been even bigger, you know. So that was another fall through.
So you basically got unlucky throughout the 70s with record labels. I know that James Bennett, after the group broke up, he released a record as the Chi-Town Hustlers.
Yeah, I remember him.
And so did you continue to do music?
During that time, what year are we talking now?
Like 79?
During that time period, I think for me it was just about through. Because after the New Orleans deal, coming back from that and nothing had happened, nothing was going right. In fact, all that area what's the tornado that hit down there? Well, not the tornado. We played in all that area, Appaloosas, Baton Rouge, St. Charles, all that area. I look back at that and said, man, I was going to actually move down there.
Okay.
I stayed down there for about 5 months, and I was glad I didn't, because that area was hit.
Okay.
By Katrina.
Yeah.
So during that time period, I came back and, you know, life had to change. And now for the brighter side, you want to ask this or you want me to tell it?
Go ahead.
Yeah. So during this time, I had a lot of questions that weren't answered. And I started praying heavily because, you know, I wasn't a druggie, but I got high like the average person drinking. And I needed some answers. And during this time period, I was asking God, what do you want me to do with my life? You know, nothing's going right. You gave me this talent, and I just don't know. I said, let me know. And I remember praying those prayers. And the change in my life came when I was shacking with someone. And she asked me, you want Jehovah's Witness to come by? And I said, yeah, I'd like to talk to them. And the moment I talked to them, I understood what was happening.
Okay.
And life had changed. And, you know, I'm a Jehovah's Witness now, my two kids. And life had just turned around completely. So I look at music totally differently now. I still play every now and then, but I'm not trying to make it to the top to be that big, successful player. No.
Do you play gospel music, or what kind of music?
No, I don't play gospel. Jehovah's Witness don't play gospel. I still play, okay, the type of stuff I do now is like the beginning of the WNUAs. I would say I'm closer to George Duke type
okay.
of music. I like that kind of funk
and smooth jazz, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, are you planning to release anything, or is it just something you do on your own?
Well, I would like to get a CD out, and actually, I'm working on my own material at this time. I not just play the drums; I play guitar and keyboards and a little bass, and I sing lead.
Okay.
And so I've been doing the course of this time period. I've been working on my own material. I'd like to actually, if I can get. To open up on some of these acts that they have in the city. And I have members that I pull in when I get ready to do a show or something. So it's like, it's still like a big band, like two horns.
So you have a band together that can do shows now,
right?
Saying?
And a lead singer, her name is Topaz.
Okay.
Hey, Topaz.
Okay, well, if anyone is looking for a band, or you can get in contact with, do you have an email address or some way to get in contact?
Not an email, no, just the numbers right now.
Okay, well, you can call the station and get in contact with me, and I could pass it on.
Right.
And if you release any material, I'll definitely let people know about it.
I'd appreciate that.
Yeah. Okay, so thanks so much for coming down and telling your story.
Well,
it's an interesting story.
All right.
Do you have any last words for the listening audience?
Oh, okay. For those that are listening, let's start with UP, Union Pacific Railroad, where I work. Break time if you're listening. Hello, you guys out there from Union Pacific, Pat and the rest, and some of my Jehovah's Witness friends. I can't call everybody's name. Some of you skaters that are listening. Oh, I skate too, and I've met... I still skate at my age. We have fun at the rink.
Well, that's huge on the South Side, roller skating, right?
Right.
Okay.
And I've seen some of the old people I still used to, you know, hang out with. Some of you rink people. And thank you for listening. You know, I hope you enjoyed what you heard. And Bob, I guess he'll give us a copy of this. So.
Okay, well, thanks so much for coming down.
Okay, Bob.
So this last record I'm going to play is The Sons of Slum. This track is called The Push and Pull.